Hello everyone and welcome to another Windows 7 webcast here on Channel 9 Studios. With me today, Ben and Rob. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Rob Jarrett. I'm a software design engineer on the Windows 7 taskbar team.
And my name is Ben Betts. I'm also a software design engineer on the Windows 7 taskbar team.
Yes, and today we're very excited to have you here. Finally, we can actually talk about the taskbar architecture and the internals of how it works after having a couple of movies describing its functionality, a little bit of the history, design iteration, and et cetera. So, Rob, why don't you please describe, you know, what is the taskbar, little pieces that combine it into the Windows 7 new taskbar?
Sure thing. Well, the taskbar is what we call an application bar or an app bar, and that's just a window that docks at the side of the screen. It's a top-level HWind, and there's really three main pieces to it. There's the actual start button that we have on the lower left side, and that, of course, invokes the start menu. The center portion of the taskbar is what effectively amounts to a rebar control. This is basically a host for one or more toolbars that show up on the taskbar. And by default, there's one toolbar that is present, and that's a special case, actually, of a toolbar, which is something called the task band. So each of the toolbars that are hosted in the center of the taskbar, we refer to as desk bands, and the default toolbar that shows up is what we call the task band. That's where your pinned applications reside, as well as any open windows that you have on your desktop can be found. And on the far right of the taskbar is this area here, which is, of course, the notification area. And that's kind of its own separate piece to things. That's where the user can manage their notification icons. Of course, the clock lives there, as well as the new Show Desktop button.
So that is very interesting. I thought the taskbar is just one piece, and now you're actually telling us it's comprised of three different components. Interesting. So we are going to focus on the centerpiece, right? On the task band.
On the task band, yeah.
Excellent. So maybe you could drive a little bit and explain how the architect supporting the task band works.
Sure thing. Well, like I mentioned, the task band is a special case of a desk band. And we can kind of start by just talking about where its content comes from. So in terms of both the pinned items as well as the windows themselves that that end up on the task band. So for the window portion of things, we actually get notifications from the lower level operating system's window manager that will inform us of when windows are both created, destroyed, and also if any aspect of the window might change, such as its window text or maybe its window icon. So the window manager will actually notify the task band through just a well-defined interface of certain events that are occurring. So to say, hey, a window just got created. And when a window gets created, well, the task band needs to know what group that it should insert that window into. So the items on the task band are divided up into separate groups, and each group effectively corresponds to having its own unique app ID. So in the PDC talks that we gave at the recent PDC, we talked about, you know, a little bit about this, how things are divided up on the taskbar. And if
you're opting into this and you're
sure.
going to write your own, you're going to opt into the taskbar experience with jump list we're going to cover soon, you do want to have your own app ID, right? You want to generate your own app ID.
Absolutely. Though? Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that Ben will be covering shortly. And
yeah, the key thing really is that the app ID is what we use to put each of the windows into the groups that they're in. And by default, as you can see on the screen, we've got just single buttons for each app, and each of those corresponds to an app ID. There are certainly ways in which an app can opt into that and provide an app ID to us, but if you haven't done that, you're an existing application that you've been out there for years, we do a series of heuristics to try and generate an app ID for you. So most applications should run just fine with the brand new taskbar and get into the right group.
Yes, availability is important.
Absolutely. So yeah, as far as then how we determine the app ID, so you know, we get a notification that a window has been created, let's say. We need to figure out which group or which app ID that each window corresponds to. So the taskband then essentially farms out that task to something that we call the app resolver. And that's a component that executes the heuristics that Ben just mentioned. Oops. That uses a number of different factors to essentially tell us what the app ID of the application is that owns that HWind. It's actually a background process that occurs. So it calls the taskband back once it figures out what group the window should belong to. The taskband then inserts the HWind into its data model, into the corresponding correct group, and then adjusts the user interface accordingly to expose that.
Cool.
So as far as how the pinned items work then, they actually come from an internal list of shortcuts that the user has pinned. That's a closed list of data. We certainly don't want any applications playing around with it. We want the user to remain in control. And that's a list that we populate at startup, and we get notifications whenever the contents of that list change so that we can keep the items up to date on the taskband. And those, of course, those shortcuts themselves have their own app ID that of course, create initially the task groups with that have that app ID.
Okay.
So that we know where to put future HWinds as well.
So how exactly the taskbar know how to show jump list?
Sure. Well, because we know the application ID, there are some APIs that we can use to actually query the contents of what a jump list should have. Ben, if you want to
As Rob mentioned, each button on the taskbar has an app ID from its shortcut. You know, if it's pinned, even if the application isn't running, we certainly get it from Windows, but we also get it from the shortcuts. And then for each application, we store two different types of jump lists. One is the custom list that an app can provide to us. And if they haven't done that, we've got what we call the automatic list. And it's basically a list of all the recent and frequent documents that the application has been using. And so when the user right-clicks on any of the buttons on the taskbar, we'll say, well, let's go find the jump lists based on that app ID. And then at the user interface level, we basically merge the two lists together and generate what the user ends up seeing. So if we can just show this here, for example, on Word, if I do a right click there, you'll see that up pops its recent list. And that list is populated based upon, like I said, the automatic collection of document usage that the shell maintains for us. And then there are a couple other tasks that are inserted into the jump list, and these are put in by the system to help manage the application. So you'll see pin and or unpin the application, as well as a button to launch the application, which also exposes a right-click menu so you can get properties about the shortcut that's pinned there.
Okay.
And so then, just to update our diagram here, that we're kind of working from, you can think of there being a data store of the jump list items that we query in order to display the menu of all the jump list links.
So the data model of the taskbar, or the taskband actually, it's, you know, very nice, but if you look at a taskbar, taskband, you see it's high graphics, very visual. How did you guys accomplish that?
Well, the animations that we have in the taskband are, I guess, at the lowest level, are driven by a new component for Windows 7 called the Scenic Animation Platform, and that is it's actually two pieces to that component, which are, there's an animation manager portion and an animation timer. And the animation manager is something that tracks all of the in-progress animations. It's effectively a math box that can deal with different transition paths and interpolation, dealing with the creation and destruction of animations that are occurring. And the animation timer portion is what drives that animation manager to essentially advance, you know, the timing of things. And as far as the role that the task band then plays, it implements all of the rendering and the graphics side of things, but the underlying data structures for the animations occurring are from the Scenic Animation platform.
Okay, so what were the, you know, problems you encountered during that development of?
Sure, there's a number of interesting factors that come about when you're dealing with so much more of a dynamic environment to your application. You know, certainly things like performance were tough to really get right. With the task band, or task bar as a whole, that's a peripheral component that should tend to stay out of applications' ways when the user is not using it, but you really want it to be available and very present when the user wants to interact with it. So to get performance right and to not have animations be a performance hog on the system or to needlessly drain resources, you know, for example, on a laptop, the last thing that we want to do is, you know, reduce battery life because you have a really fancy-looking taskbar. We decided to kind of take a couple of approaches when it came to the classes of animations that we had. One was the fact that we have this notion of a peripheral animation, which are animations that occur as a result of the user that just occur as a result of events happening in the system. So, for example, a window opens and we actually show a button on the task band. That is a peripheral animation because that wasn't anything that the user is actually interacting with. The second class of animation, though, is what we call an interactive animation. This is when the user is explicitly interacting with the task band. They're using their mouse or keyboard to drive its UI. In those instances, we can use a little bit more system resources, a little bit more, fancier or larger scaled graphics animations, so that because it's a fairly infrequent thing when the user interacts with the task band, it's expected, I think, by the end user that
it's upon user request. So
exactly,
I guess you want
exactly, yeah. So really just kind of that design aspect even of really just realizing that there's two classes of animations that can occur was kind of an interesting thing. As far as the eventing, though, I think that was probably one of the tougher aspects where you're in this dynamic environment, things are happening in real time. Just debugging certain things can be very difficult because there may be certain bugs that occur where, if this particular animation is occurring when suddenly this other window triggers this animation, you know, things could go wrong. And to actually resolve that kind of an issue can be pretty difficult. So something that we found helpful was to have what we call like a slow mode to the animations, where rather than having all the animations occur at their regular rate, we slow them down by, say, a factor of 10, where you can actually start something animating and then quickly, you know, go over to somewhere else on the task band and trigger another animation so that you can see how things interact together, see how changing of the state of the system can affect the animations. And not only can that help find any outright bugs with things, but it can also allow us to really refine a great end user experience so that things can integrate better with one another instead of having animations stop midway and jump to a different state immediately. They can instead transition into that new state so that it's very subtle, but when the end user is using the taskbar or the task band sort of at full speed, so to speak, they get this really great seamless feeling experience where everything's just kind of working together very well.
What Rob's sort of talking about here is the way we're able to show what we call the extended UI, which is the list of windows and all the thumbnails that pop up when you either hover over or click on a button on the taskbar that has more than one window showing on it. So I'm going to pop up the Visual Studio's extended UI here, and you see the two different thumbnails right here. And some of that transition that he's talking about is if you're to move over to another button that has another set of windows, and you see that really smooth transition in both number of items that are in the extended UI as well as the content, and you see crossfades and size changes. And as if a user's mousing between these buttons very quickly, it can start transitioning from each one and starting to tween between each of them very quickly. So you'll see this one come up and move over here and move back and that type of thing. You can see how they're able to slide back and forth. And we really think it's a very cool effect.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, another case for this is as we're transitioning between two groups of thumbnails on the taskbar, well, it could also be that the user has perhaps hovered away from the taskbar while that morphing animation is occurring, and so that the entire user interface would start to tear down as it normally does when it, you know, kind of pops up and then pops back down. To get that right and to have what the user would expect to happen, which is the morphing continues and yet we also are animating to our, you know, to the invisible state, then it, you know, that just works. And so that's something that the slowing down of animations can help out a lot with, so.
Debugging everything, yeah. So yeah, it makes sense that you, when you animate something, you want to have it in slow-mo just to make sure that everything, all the transitions are nice.
Absolutely.
Cool. So I've noticed that once you take the mouse and you hover over of the icons,
yeah,
you get some fancy colors, right? I know we call it color hot tracking. We covered some of that in previous Stefan already showed exactly the different prototype. But I would be more interested in you know, explaining how does it work.
How that works.
How does the color, you know, pop up that with that color?
I mean, sure.
It's something that is dynamic and it's not something we pre-populated in advance, right?
To show the color hot tracking, we effectively show the what we call the dominant color of the icon. And the dominant color can kind of mean a few things, but what we took it to mean as we took that to mean the color with the most frequency that shows up in the icon. And so a very simple version of the algorithm could be you just look at every single color in the icon and you count how many times it occurs, and then you just choose the color that has the most occurrences. And that's kind of what we do. We do actually allow a little bit of variance to the colors, because oftentimes icons may have slightly different shades of a color if they're trying to show perhaps any reflection type effects or things of that nature. And so we allow a certain amount of buffer between how we compute the frequencies of the colors, as well as we ignore certain colors because we know that their light, the light effect that we would generate based on that color would not look any good. And for example, black is an obvious color. Or dark gray. We ignore blacks, grays, and whites because their colors just, well, they're really not colors, so to speak. And so the effect that they would give with our rendering of the color effect just wouldn't look any good. So in those cases, we actually default to just a standard color, which is part of the theme file. So in terms of how we actually go about rendering the effect, there's kind of two parts to it. And we went through a lot of iteration on this. You know, you mentioned that Stefan did talk about this, one of the designers on the task band. At its core, the color hot tracking is a radial gradient, and it has essentially a couple of components to it. It has both. If you look at if you imagine the radial gradient, that this is the center of the gradient, and that this is the outer edge. That the center of the radial gradient is always white, and then it actually blends into the target color along the gradient. So this is, you can think of this being the final color here of the gradient. And as well, there's a transparency aspect to it of the gradient, which is the is essentially how the opacity works. Mm-hmm. So how it blends along. The center of the radial gradient is 100% opaque, and it fades out along a certain ramp. And we took a lot of great pains to try and get it to look as good as it really could. I know that Stefan would give me bitmaps, essentially, that he would render of how the effect should look. And then I would actually go through and take a look at the alpha values of each of the pixels and then define a function that would match, as closely match as we could to what that actually looked like, and so that we could get, you know, as accurate a representation of what the designers were thinking about for it. And so we draw this radial gradient, really just a circle that has, you know, the center is white and it blends out to the dominant color of the icon, as well as it fades out at the edges. But we also clip that to the inside of the actual taskbar button. And we also do an additional effect, which is something to kind of give it a bit of a reflective feel inside of the glass panes that we have. So if you take a look at the edges and the top of the icons here, you can see that not only is there just that radial gradient rendering, but there's an additional kind of enhanced or more dramatic effect in the actual edges of the button to kind of give that feel of refraction occurring to the light that's going through there. And so and that effect is essentially just a little bit more of a dramatic or a little bit more of an enhanced radial gradient that we draw. And so we just draw it through an actual region, effectively. So it's just really just a couple pixel thick border that we draw a thicker or a higher radius radial gradient through. And so getting the performance of that right was also a tough task, because that's a lot of bit twiddling and a lot of computation involved. But it's something that we worked really hard at. You know, I think we've gotten more than satisfactory results out of, you know, how fast that we can render that
It renders,
kind of effect.
It renders really quickly. Really quick. So we actually compute every time. I mean, it's dynamic. We do not do anything in advance for, like, new icons or when the application installs and it has an icon.
So we compute it. It's kind of a combination. We compute it only when we need to. And that, what that means is we compute it once we find out what the icon is for the application. Or actually, we compute it when we need to draw the radial, the color hot tracking for the particular group. So, and then we remember that color throughout the lifetime of that group on the taskbar.
Okay.
And so that we're not doing a lot of redundant calculation.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the rendering, we pre-compute a few things. Not a huge amount, but we do pre-compute a little bit when it comes to things like making the drawing of the circle and the gradient ramp, you know, making that a lot more efficient. So we, you know, it occupies maybe, I think it's something in the order of a couple hundred bytes or something of a table that we use to render the actual gradient effect with.
Cool.
So
that's nice. You know, many consumers, users have asked us to be able to change the location of the icons on the taskbar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have enabled that. I mean, you can take one of,
yeah.
You know, you can just show how you can actually grab, run, and move it. So how was that done?
Well, that was done by, it's a fairly straightforward kind of UI behavior. But in our case, in terms of getting some of the animations down, that's really the result of, I think, just a general philosophy that we took when it comes to adding animation to our model, which is whenever there's a state change and that we want any animation to occur, so in this case, whenever you're rearranging the button and we figure out that we need to move one button from one location to another, we immediately change our data model state into that sort of final state, so to speak, and then we choose to animate to it. So rather than try and keep things in this little bit of a, you know, in limbo kind of a state where, well, where as I'm dragging one button over another, where do the two buttons live on the taskbar, we actually make the swap immediately at the start of the animation, and then we animate the button that's moving to its final destination.
Cool.
So and like I said, that was just a general philosophy that we decided to take for all of the animations that we were implementing, or at least most of them in the task band. There's a couple cases, particularly to do with the destruction of items, where you can't really jump into its final state and have things animate to that. For example, if a window is going away, we want its button to collapse or fade away on the task band. If we immediately let that object be destroyed and go away, well, then we have nothing to actually animate. So we kind of, in that case, we do need to keep it around in at least some form so that we can fade it away. And then once the animation is complete, we can go ahead and clean up any resources like its icon or any memory that it occupies. So,
cool. That makes sense. Okay, so this was very interesting, very thorough a review of their taskbar and taskband architecture. I'm looking forward for, continuous session. Ben, I believe we have another one coming up soon.
Yeah, I'm going to dive into how it is that applications can build jump lists and really how we compute those app IDs to give developers a better idea, really how to target the best experience they can in the new taskbar.
Excellent. So with that, I want to thank you both very much.
Of course.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's been great.
Excellent. Yes, thank you very much. Thank you.